Joe is in private practice in Washington, D.C. as a transportation urban design expert.
Oh.
And he's working on a number of things that, that are kind of interesting. He's a kind of neat guy. I like Joe.
Yeah,
he was probably one of the better architectural administrators that have come out of the post-war years. But that's just... Well, anyway, so that's what I'm doing. And what you've said essentially is that you think something, another structuralist movement is coming?
Well...
Or an offshoot of it?
An offshoot of the structuralist movement. That is becoming, it's growing out of a kind of connection not to the possibilities of physical form so much as say the form of human behavior patterns. Say the structure of human behavior patterns. Where if you say we were looking at the possibilities of physical form, how they gave shape to things in the world. Could you imagine then that, in a kind of crude way, you could say the structure that the designer is faced with is involved with things and persons and places. These things must occupy places in the world, and they have some relationship to persons as well. And how do you design something that in some way communicates your perception of the relationship that might exist or could exist or a necessity exists between those three components? There's some kind of interesting value systems that grow out of this, especially if you look at any designed artifact as communicating something. What does it communicate in the context of the place that you find it, the kind of place that you find it, the kinds of persons it is involved with, or the specific persons. And interestingly enough, one can begin to engage students with those kinds of issues without having to, let's say, talk about the traditional archetypes of good design. You can say, what in hell does this thing do? What do you perceive that this does if it's done in this way?
That's a pretty complex problem.
Hmm?
That has even more unknowns to deal with.
I don't know. We find, for instance, the students, you know, if you engage them with a simple thing about what is redundant in this message that you're sending? What is novel in this message that you're sending? What do you pay attention to when you see the message? When the thing is organized in some particular way, what do you find you and people like you seem to pay attention to it? Can you pay attention to it at all? Do you recognize even that design has taken place? Would you detect that had been designed at all? What would be the properties of something where you would detect that it had been designed at all? Then if you detect it, how do you interpret it?
And how do you define design?
Yeah. Well, this can be quite subjective. If you detect it, then we cannot argue with you. But what is it you're detecting?
Yeah.
When you say you've detected something, what do you think you've detected? Well, it tends to lead, I think, to some very positively, well, it's not greatly different from the earlier constructivist movement, in some ways, where things are built in some kind of positive sense, and you look at it and say, what about doing?
Well, anyway, but that's essentially what I'm interested in, what I'm doing right now. And what I'd like to do, if I could, is to sort of just take you back to 48, see if we can talk about some issues that happened then. Henry came here from Oklahoma,
right,
with four faculty. You were one of them. Who are the other three?
Well, the numbers are kind of strange. George Matsumoto came at the time. Jim Fitzgibbon came at the time. Terry Wall came at the time. And a chap from Texas was to have come by the name of Hugo Leipziger Pierce. He came much later. And a chap by the name of Bruce Goff was to have come, but decided not to. He stayed on in Oklahoma and headed the school there for a while.
But Henry had thought about bringing Goff up here with him?
I think the suggestion was strongly made, and Bruce chose not to do that.
When the group of you were, did the group of you come to visit Raleigh before you decided to come? Did you just send Henry out as a scout?
No, Henry came as a scout, and then a group from North Carolina State came to Oklahoma and interviewed us all. This consisted of Dean Cloyd and the dean of the faculty was Dean Cloyd, I think, and some other faculty member whose name I cannot recall. And Henry had come over here and had extensive interviews with the people here, and I think it was at the time also that he was contemplating the possibility of moving to Columbia University. We all had a meeting, as I recall, in Henry's living room out there in Oklahoma, and the prospect seemed so challenging and so interesting, as anything like that would be when, in a sense, you had a school that was starting over more or less from scratch. But this was an interesting prospect for all of us to contemplate. Not only did we come over here, but there were a fairly significant number of students who came as well from Oklahoma and transferred over here. I'm sure you remember some of that very well.
Yeah. In the initial discussions about coming, was there any clear statement or clear conception of an educational philosophy that the group of you had put together that you found was withering on the vine down there at Oklahoma, that you felt you wanted to get into another climate that might be more receptive?
Yeah, there was. Some of it consisted, I think, of negative statements. Some of it consisted of positive statements. The difficulties at Oklahoma, I believe, were largely that the school was still under the aegis of the school engineering in some ways, and that many of the support facilities for the school in Oklahoma. We're under the aegis of the School of Fine Arts. And that there had always been, it seemed to us, a conflict between what we now would refer to as the designer attitude and the fine arts attitude. Although the fine artist and the designer must share many similar sensibilities and skills, that their attitudes toward the world were sufficiently different that they seemed to be genuinely, at least in that environment, in conflict.
Were you in the architecture program?
No, I was in the fine arts school. And the others were in the School of Architecture. And moving into the design environment, for me personally, was a very exciting prospect. And, I liked the idea of that. Because I felt very restive, I must say, in the School of Fine Arts. There seemed to be more interesting challenges in the area of design.
Were there other concepts that y'all had, that the group of you had, in contemplating, start a new school on the basis of something which was really not strong at all, as you say, almost like starting from scratch?
Yeah, well, I think perhaps the strongest one was that there was the possibility and the fact of an existing school of landscape architecture of some fairly reasonable properties here. There was a state which had essentially a very well-developed furniture industry, a fairly well-developed ceramics industry, and a thoroughly well-developed textile industry. So that there were many components that were related to more generalized design products than architecture. So that there seemed to be a genuine possibility of a more broadly based design program, of which architecture was certainly a central and vital part, but there would be other things going on as well, which we felt would help the education aspect, as opposed, let's say, to the training aspect of designers. That they would be rubbing shoulders with similar kinds of people, but with somewhat dissimilar goals, which we thought would be quite positive. And in a way, up until fairly recently here, I think this has been true.
So the major concept, as you saw it, was a concept that looked in a holistic fashion at design.
That's right. And it's kind of interesting that Bucky should land on the scene right at that time, because in his own view, this is precisely what he was trying to do. At the same time, Matthew Nowitzki came to us from, I think he was connected at that time with the Harrison and Abramovitz
with the UN
relationship to the UN project. But I think, and Matthew certainly tried to take a holistic view of architecture, although he believed, I think, to his dying day that and was not loath to state it again and again, that architecture was the mother of the arts. or father, whatever. But certainly those two people coming at that time, with no let or hindrance, in fact, with every encouragement from Henry Kingpin, I thought, tended to reinforce the point of view that in the kind of romantic and, I must say, hazy way we brought with us.
When you came, you certainly hadn't contemplated a sort of leap into the whole question of structure and form generation and the things that you've done. What was it that generated that? Even Fitz himself, I don't think, had a real kind of bias toward this sort of thing. What was it that generated, not over a period of years, but almost immediately in the school, overnight in the school, that kind of strong direction that the school took in terms of structuralism or construction, or the relationship of structure and form to design? Maybe if
that's hard. You know, well,
maybe you ought to center it on yourself, Duncan. You know, how did you become involved?
In my own experience, I think it arrived by two somewhat separate routes that fused together fairly early on. And that is, in having to teach the basic design program, or having the responsibility for teaching in it, there were questions that lurked in the back of my mind as to how would I get at what was really basic? And it wasn't just me, myself and others. Now, I might point out that fairly early on as well, we had two people come in here, Les Lasky and Roy Gusso from the Institute of Design in Chicago, who, in their contact with Maholi and Chermayev, knew damn well what was basic. You know, there was no question in their mind. But there were others of us where there were say, genuine questions as to what basic issues might be, and for one reason or another, we focused on the physical world more or less exclusive of man. We took for granted that anything of a more fundamental nature that we could find out about relationships in the physical world, be they form or color or whatever, that man would somehow go along with it, and that our own sensibilities, being men, if we felt good about it, then others would feel so good about it. So we didn't really need to pay too much attention to that. And I think you remember that fairly well, don't you? It began with simply trying to explore the possibilities, for me anyway, of physical relationships, and to encourage students in my classes to do so. Now, in my naivete, I suppose, the difficulties, or the events that took place were, say, some strangely recurrent phenomena. That is, a student would explore and would come up with something that you had seen examples of that other students exploring had come up with. My gosh, why is it that these, say, certain kinds of basic relationships, when one starts to explore, seem to recur again and again and again? That made me curious. And then at that point, Bucky came along and introduced a perhaps more rigorous, more clearly defined mode of exploring this domain. So there was a great deal of enthusiasm at that point for before doing this sort of thing. I must say, Matthew Novitsky at the same time came from a circumstance not greatly dissimilar, I would say, from that of either Gusso or Lasky or Shashi Novitsky, for that matter, who out of the European tradition had grown up in a world of archetypes which were known to be architecture. And these were, for them, really fundamental issues. And they were quite different from what was happening in my design class, and I'm curious about that as well. So I would say the concatenation of trying to get at some issues that I felt were genuinely fundamental in a design fundamentals program, and the fact that people like Novitsky and Fitzgibbon with his explorations into natural form and so on, and triggered that. That's where it began.
So basically, it wasn't a question of, at least as you see it, of a group of people having a real interest in developing a deep look into structure or construction, but it was the rather fortuitous kind of gathering together of people with who were inquisitive, who had an open mind, coming together, excuse me, and finding some community of interest in this.
And part of it, I think, as much a part of it, was Bucky on the one hand for me and Jim Fitzgibbon on the other, where Jim was very preoccupied at the time with structure, because he seemed to have a rather firm belief, or possibly firm hope, that this was going to be a very productive direction for him as an architect, because he was really searching for a direction for himself. And I think perhaps this is one of the reasons that he became ultimately so firmly connected to Bucky. And in all candor, I would say that anybody reared as firmly and devoutly in the Catholic faith as Jim, the need for some kind of a pope in all aspects of what he was doing was there.
Well, as you know, Jim had come out of a true Beaux-Arts tradition, too, in terms of architecture.
And he didn't believe in it at all.
Well, assuming that, I'm going to try and figure this out this afternoon when I get into the archives, assuming that Bucky did come in the spring of 49, really, during the first year of the operation of the school. Do you recall any of the things he did that immediately sort of, did you immediately that first year sort of get excited by the things that Bucky was doing, or did, I remember Bucky came back each year then for a period of at least 7 years.
Well, the first year, he was here, as I recall, maybe 2 weeks, possibly three, I think more like 2 weeks. And his activity was largely going through energetic geometry, which was in its formative stages at that point, and describing to us his activities first at Black Mountain College, and then at the Institute of Design in Chicago, and subsequent activities that he'd been engaged in relative to some contractual proposals he was making to the government, perhaps the Air Force. I can't recall exactly what it was, but I know there was something out in the court of the Pentagon building that he had built, and so on. Some work he'd been doing with a chap named Don Richter, another chap named Jeffrey Lindsay, and another, strictly enough, the sculptor Ken Snelson. Uh,
And the thing that I found that particularly engaged me was the connection of what Bucky had been talking about in energetic geometry, the immediate connection to some of the phenomena that had been occurring in my basic design studios. And it seemed to me that this might be a fruitful avenue for further pursuit. Not only myself and Jim, but at the time, George Matsumoto was intensely interested as well. And there was another, two young faculty members, a chap named John Melman, who's now somewhere out on the West Coast, I can't recall where, and a guy named Lee Hodgson, who is now doing some very interesting work his own way up at Cornell. So there were a bunch of very young people. I was very young at the time. There was Lee, and there was Jim, and there was John Melman, there was George Matsumoto. And we were all sort of chock-a-block in those barracks up there, with all sorts of students around, and everybody was intensely busy exploring things. And it was kind of interesting, to me was that the exploration did not appear to have any really clearly defined goal. We weren't trying to find Chicago or some new continent or something necessarily. We were just exploring some phenomena. And it was a very exciting thing to do.
Now, as I understand it, Bucky's spatial geometry at that time was very embryonic, not particularly not particularly provable in terms of rigorous mathematical methods.
Well, some aspects of it were simply rediscoveries of phenomena that had been uncovered by others. Incredibly extended period of time into the past. I'm not sure that Bucky even knew about it, because Bucky was not a voracious reader of works other than his own.
But how did you get involved in, to go from a fine art school and into basic design, and then into really what is a very complex spatial geometry kind of interest?
I suppose as much as anything, my initial involvement was start at the University of Oklahoma, where I taught some courses that were at least significantly populated, not by fine art students, but by architecture students. And my colleague-like contacts at the university tended to be as strongly with the architecture school as they were with the fine art school. So it started there, and in the long run, I think I found the architecture students on the average as interesting or more interesting than the fine art students.
But even the architecture students didn't have a particular bias toward an interest in spatial geometry and construction. That wasn't the flavor of the school at Oklahoma.
No, it wasn't.
But they were interested, in some sense, in structuring their lives. With some sort of body of interaction that was outside of themselves. Where the fine art students tended to be almost entirely centered within themselves. What am I going to do? What am I going to say to the world? Rather than how am I going to interact with the world? The world had to come to them rather than they going to the world. This seemed to be the difference between, say, the architecture students in a way and the fine arts students.
In the basic design courses that you taught, they obviously had a very Bauhaus ID flavor to them because of the people who were here. That flavor predominantly, I guess, could be characterized, at least to some degree, by the descriptive term of abstraction, looking at abstract principles and how they affected design decision making, leading to a whole question of symbolism. Question of symbolism in design. And yet very quickly the basic design flavor became a flavor of dealing with constructivist things. Toothpick assemblages, string assemblages, things like that. Did that come out of ID also?
No.
How did that get generated here?
I think as much as anything, it got generated out of trying to structure an exploration into what possible relationships existed in a structured organization of space. We weren't necessarily looking for that which was desirable, simply looking for that which was possible, and possibly that which was necessary. Well, for instance, in Gusso's direction, it was more than necessary. What is the minimum necessary set of relationships to have something that was genuinely spatial? The three mutually perpendicular intersecting lines, let's say. And you really needed no more than that. And that sculpture in the garden downstairs is one of the ongoing results of what he was doing. You remember Jose de Rivera later on, the same sort of thing. Or the interaction between Jose and Roy. But I think myself and Jim, Melman, Hodgkin and others were simply asking a much simpler question of what are the possible relationships. And the stick and string things grew out of, I think mostly, taking off from some things that Bucky had talked about in that first series of lectures on energetic geometry and the manifestations that those lectures had led to, or that activity had led to, in the case of Ken Snelson at Black Mountain.
Had Ken been at Black Mountain?
He'd been at Black Mountain. And he was the one who discovered tensegrity. Bucky is a little loath to say much about that, but but Ken was the guy who laid that one bare, or whatever. And it became an interesting idea for us of what appears, I suppose, now to be some fairly simplistic notions about simple direct stress structures, where you could differentiate them into compression members and tension members and so on. And then the question was, are there, you know, with the stability notion of, say, four components, four non-coplanar components at one point in space, what sort of organizations could you get in those that were stable? How could you arrive at, say, the minimum structure that would establish a stable configuration? You recall, they were fairly primitive and naive things. But I'm not the least bit ashamed of them. In fact, I think we ought to be proud of them, in spite of the naivety.
Well, but then after that, you know, that first few years, Duncan, there seemed to be, obviously, the death of Novitsky was an unfortunate incident in the school, because it really never gave Novitsky the opportunity to develop a direction that was discernible. You know, the Dorton Arena is maybe a unique building, you know, that may not have reflected really a bias that Matthew had, or may not have gone on to anything else.
Well, I can remember how it came about. The Dorton Arena was a really very interesting. Because I was on the sidelines watching that happen. And there were all sorts of other schemes that were lying. And that was, I think Matthew arrived at that one. But I don't know what lay behind it, other than his statement, which grew out of, say, the shape that the arena had to be given by the client, say, the agriculture people. And Matthew's perception that the greatest, that the seating, the optimal seating would place the greatest number of people in effect on the 50-yard line. And that sight lines dictated that the seating should follow a certain pattern. And so that the arena and the seating and the sight lines suggested to him that, God, why can't we have a covering structure that follows that pattern? And the arena grew out of that, which is, seems to be quite logical. I don't think that Matthew brought any baggage with him from some other place that said, gee, that I think maybe we'll do this one with a membrane structure at the outset. But that was something that emerged in the course of a long and painful look at the problem.
Matthew, of course, at least in my perception, and you have to understand that many of these things are subjective, in my view right now, I may hopefully actually be able to sort out some. But as you know, Matthew had a very close relationship with Vero Sarin.
Not at that time, I don't think so.
Well, as I understand it, even at that time, even before he came here, that even during the year he was here, he was working with Sarin on a number of projects. See, the thing I noticed.
Matthew died and was killed in the summer of 50.
It was 50, yeah. He had just been here 1 year.
Well, he was here the 48-49 school year. And
I was here 2 years.
The 49-50 school year. And I think it was during the 49-50 school year that he made the contact with Sarah in the sense they became firmed up. But I think he and Matsumoto and some others have been working, started work in the spring of 49 on some proposals for the Darton Arena, or what became the Darton Arena.
Saren is involved in this for a variety of reasons. This is just a sort of an aside, Duncan, but Saren is involved in this for a number of reasons. Saren was a very talented, though somewhat eclectic, architect, whose major architectural works, with few exceptions, had at least visual evidences of this structuralist kind of bias, you know. Now, by and large, they were visual evidences of a structuralist bias of structural principles really only dimly perceived. Most of them have some real serious problems if looked at from a rational behavioral standpoint, a rational structural standpoint. And certainly some of them are somewhat derivative. Certainly the Ingalls hockey rink at Yale is a derivative structure. It's derivative of the Dorton Arena. And of course, the reason I'm interested is I'm looking at the linkages that could have existed between Matthew and Saren in that relationship they had.
Well, I think the chapel at MIT, Saren did, in some ways was an outgrowth of the contact with Matthew. Because Matthew, and I think in his connection with Saren, was making some proposals for Brandeis at the time. Mm-hmm. And the chapel at MIT seems to be very similar in many ways in concept to some proposals that Matthew was making for Brandeis.
Well, let's get back to yourself, you know. Okay, here's Bucky coming to the school in spring of 49, the first year here. And Bucky proposes a kind of spatial geometry that I think only reason would admit you developed. In other words, I think, you know.
Well, I helped develop.
Well, but you know, you were the first one to really sort of close the circle on the formal aspects of that spatial geometry. Mm. And that's a that's an interesting thing. What I'm really interested in finding out is, you know, what really set you on that track, Duncan? That was an unusual break to make with the past, which was really not in that direction at all. You know, that was an enormous step to take.
It really wasn't that big a break. When I look back into my own background, I had come up through the route of the Depression kid in a Depression neighborhood. Where you built things because you didn't have money to buy things. I was an avid builder of kites and model airplanes and sailing model ships that actually worked. We sailed them on ponds and one thing and another. Later on, I was heavily involved in the design, commercially, of stage scenery. And the scene designer, was technical director of a summer theater, was interested in lighting and the building and mounting of scenery and the design of scenery and so on, so that there was a fairly long backlog of direct experience in my life of making things and getting some sense of how they went together. And I can't help but believe that kind of activity, especially if it's actively engaged in by all of the other kids, or a significant bunch of the other kids that you associate with, that that doesn't somehow cause you to look at the world in some kind of way.
There are lots of kids that grow up building things, don't they, that become master carpenters and master builders that don't get involved